Dr. John E. Mack on the phenomenon of alien abductions.
One of the things that became very persuasive to me that something real was occurring to these individuals was the intensity of the energies that they felt in connection with the encounters. They would describe almost always in the same language. This language would be something like, every cell in my body is vibrating. And sometimes when they would recover their memories, and you would literally see them shake as they expressed the intensity of what they were holding in their body.
Dr. John Mack was the head of the Department of Psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School in Cambridge, Massachusetts. In 1977, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography on T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, entitled Prince of Our Disorder. Dr. Mack is best known for his research into the phenomenon known as alien abductions. His work lives on today. However, on September 27, 2004, Dr. Mack lost his life in a tragic car accident in London, England. Today, we'll hear from Ralph Blumenthal, who has just completed a biography on the life of Dr. John Mack. So stay with us here on the Files of the Disclosure Agency. My name is Victor Vigiani. Good to have you with us. Ralph Blumenthal was a New York Times reporter from 1964 to 2009, serving as a foreign correspondent in West Germany, South Vietnam, and Cambodia. He was also a national bureau chief in the southwest of the United States. There, he served as an investigative reporter and an arts writer. He was a member of the New York Times Metro Desk team that won the Pulitzer Prize for breaking news coverage of the 1992 truck bombing of the World Trade Center. In 2017, he and two colleagues broke the story of a secret Pentagon program to track UFOs with videos of encounters between the objects and Navy pilots. He is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship in addition to being the author of six nonfiction books, and Ralph Blumenthal is a distinguished lecturer. He lives in Manhattan, New York, with his wife, Deborah, a children's book author. Ralph Blumenthal, welcome to the Files of the Disclosure Agency.
Thank you, Victor. Real pleasure to meet you.
Just an absolute pleasure to have you on. Tell us what the full title is in your mind.
Okay. The full title is The Believer, Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and the Passion of John Mack. So John Mack investigated alien encounters, so that part of the subtitle. Hard Science, because I do subject his claims and the whole field to some rigorous scientific examination, which it requires. It needs to be looked at from a scientific point of view, as well as spiritual and mythical and everything else. Mm-hmm. And the passion of John Mack, the last part of the subtitle, because, first of all, he was very passionate and very enthusiastic, and it does evoke the kind of persecution suggested by even the passion of Jesus. I'm not suggesting that John Mack was crucified, but maybe close by Harvard at one point when they put him under investigation for his activities. So that's the title.
You use the word crucified, and what he went through at Harvard, and even with his own colleagues, I would suggest that he was essentially crucified. But we'll get to that later. I just want to get your, an outside perspective. You as an investigative reporter, how did you get involved with the subject of UFOs? What was the tipping point there?
Right, it wasn't my normal fare. You got that right, and yeah. I was really known for hard-nosed reporting. Investigative reporting. But one day when I was in Texas, I picked up a copy of a book which turned out to be John Mack's second book, Passport to the Cosmos. And I was blown away. I mean, it was a story of a Harvard psychiatrist who becomes captivated, good word here, by the idea of aliens and UFOs and alien abduction, and decides he's going to risk his professional career to investigate that. So he wrote a book about it. He wrote two books. This was the second, and it was even more toned down than the first book, but it completely blew me away that there would be a Harvard psychiatrist who dedicated his career to this. So I thought naively that maybe I'd call him up and do a story about him. He sounds like an interesting guy.
Right.
Not seeing how famous he already was. I mean, you had met with him and talked to him, and you certainly knew him firsthand. I knew nothing about him, and I was very naive, thinking that I had kind of discovered him. But he had been a celebrity already; he'd been in the New York Times. I said, "I'm going to, give him a call." And then a few days later, I picked up the paper to find he'd been run over in London and killed by a drunk driver. That was my introduction to John Mack, and then I pursued it, and I'm happy to tell you, what happened then. But that's how I got involved.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I guess the other question would be the person John Mack is one thing, but the kind of work that he did was, how can I put it? It caught everybody off guard. The people that knew him, when people realized what John Mack was up to begin with, how did it start? That people began to doubt his work, or at least call into question what he was doing?
Well, it was so, outlandish, really, that, the whole idea of alien abduction had been confined to the supermarket tabloids, pretty much, and, fantasy writers. And here was this esteemed Harvard psychiatrist who had won a Pulitzer Prize with a biography of Lawrence of Arabia. He had won all kinds of awards. He was esteemed in his field. He was a recognized expert in psychiatry. It caused, a sensation at Harvard, and he was not shy about presenting his work to Harvard. Within a year of learning about alien abduction from Bud Hopkins, and, we can talk about that story, but he learned about it from somebody who had already been, looking into the whole field. But no sooner did he learn about it himself that he started gathering abductees, or so-called experiencers, people who had these experiences around him, and researching their experiences and telling his Harvard students at Harvard Medical School about it. So he wasn't shy about talking about his research. So it caused a sensation at Harvard and eventually got him into trouble.
Yeah, it got him into a lot of trouble for sure. The other thing that I wanted to broach with you, and it's also one of my feelings, too, that you said you don't like being asked if you believe in UFOs or aliens or extraterrestrials. The word believe is tainted in a lot of different ways. Why did you choose the name of the book, the word The Believer?
Yeah, good question. Well, John Mack often said he was not a believer, and he said it because he said it was not a question of believing. He said, I've just been following a trail of evidence, anecdotal evidence, but the kind of evidence that gets people convicted in courts of law and executed for murder.
Mm-hmm.
He said, so I'm not a believer. I'm not just a gullible person who's, choosing to accept these stories. I really tested them out. That's what he always said.
Right.
So I kind of provocatively called my book The Believer, because I say at the end, he is a believer in things like social justice on Earth, breaking boundaries to investigate mysteries, to go where others have feared to go, and he believed in the benign consciousness of the universe. He believed in other intelligences in the universe. So he did believe in a lot of good things that I give him credit for. So that's why I call the book A Believer, but I'm aware it has a pejorative connotation in the field of somebody who's gullible, but I don't mean it in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. He told me that it's one thing to believe something, but it's another thing to know it. When you know something, that is much more meaningful than actually believing it as a matter of faith. It's not something you can actually nail down. Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we're just a few minutes away, or a few seconds away from a break. It's just what I want to do is get into, after the break, Ralph, some of the more ethereal aspects of what you delved into in the biography, because the biography was intensely well researched. You really got inside the specifics of who this man was And the amount of research you did on this was just absolutely phenomenal. So we'll take a break, and we'll be back in a moment. We're speaking with Ralph Blumenthal about his book, The Believer.
Previously on the files of the Disclosure Agency. Daniel
Sheehan. President Carter, upon taking office in January of 1977, held a meeting with then the Director of Central Intelligence, who was George Bush Sr., and demanded that the Director of Central Intelligence turn over to the President the classified information about unidentified flying objects and the information that was in the possession of the United States intelligence community concerning the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence. This information was refused to the President of the United States by the Director of Central Intelligence, George Bush Sr.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Files of the Disclosure Agency. My name is Victor Vigiani, and we are with Ralph Blumenthal, a former New York Times reporter and the author of the book, The Believer, and The Life of John Mack. Once again, great to have you with us, Ralph, and it's a real pleasure. Before the break, I alluded to the fact that the amount of research that you did for this biography was absolutely incredible. Could you just tell us a bit about how the kind of depth and, like, where did you go to get all this information? And in reading the book, each chapter was absolutely soaked with minute detail about this man's life. Like, how did you accumulate all this stuff?
Well, you know, as I said, after I found he'd been run down and killed in London, I made contact with his family and asked for access to his materials. And when I reached them, they were still in the grieving process.
It was
kind of not the best time to approach the family, but eventually we were in contact, and they agreed to give me access to all his material, his private archives, and his private journals. And as a psychiatrist, he had to subject himself to psychoanalysis. And I had access to many of his analytical sessions, which he recorded. So I really had a window into his mind and his journals, where he confided the most intimate details of his life, including his romances. He couldn't really stay away from other women despite his long-suffering wife's misery. She was very dedicated to him, Sally, and he to her, but he had a problem in terms of being interested in extramarital romance. Anyway, I saw that picture of him, warts and all, that came through his private papers, and I got, you know, to him as a rounded human being, warts and all. What drove him to his this obsession, really, this passion? And aliens wasn't the first thing he was passionate about. I can tell you about other causes he took on before he got there. But anyway, I did get a really good picture. Every biographer's dream is to get access to these papers. And everything but his private sessions with patients, which I couldn't hope to get access to. But in the end, some of that emerged, too, because he wrote about it, disguising the names. And I interviewed some of his patients myself, so I got that part of it. So everything was really an open book.
Wow, it's amazing that you got that kind of depth. In my conversations myself with Dr. Mack, as you and I talked about earlier, and others who followed his work, Mack appeared to be a man, as you stated, with a halo of perfection about him. But that seems to be, according to your biography, anything but the case. How would you characterize the difference between the private John Mack and the persona he exuded in public?
Well, he was, first of all, very charismatic, very good-looking, strikingly handsome, kind of a babe magnet by some accounts. Cobalt eyes, very engaging way of, reaching people. So there was that aspect. Supremely confident because of his towering intellect. He had great faith in his, professional abilities, and justifiably so. On the other hand, he had a lot of insecurities, as all of us do. And he was traumatized by one particular event in his life, which I talk about in the book. His mother, his birth mother, died when he was 8.5 months old. He was a baby, and she died of appendicitis. Uh-huh. Penicillin hadn't yet come into regular use. It was invented, but not common. And she died, and he was suddenly left without a mother. And his father eventually rather quickly remarried a woman with her own tragic story. Her husband had, she was a widow, and her husband had committed suicide in the Great Depression. He was a great-grandson of the Gimbel's department store family. So John Mack had acquired the stepmother, who was a very strong woman, and his whole life was searching for his birth mother, who abandoned him as he felt it when he was 8.5 months old, and his struggle to come to terms with his new mother and family. And that search, I think, translated into this search for the ineffable in the universe, the social causes he embraced, but also his search for these mysteries of the cosmos.
Yeah, the running theme of the loss of his mother runs right through virtually almost every single chapter that you wrote. It seems to be a pivotal point about how he exuded himself and how he treated just about everything. Do you want to bounce back for a second to the New York Times, if I could, before we delve into any more depth with John? It's a two-part question, I suppose, Ralph. I've always wondered about the level of decision-making at major newspapers, things like the Pentagon Papers and the Watergate situation and the Boston Globe illumination of abuse in Boston. When publishers and senior editors are sitting in a room and the gnashing of teeth goes on to either withhold or go for a particular story, what happens in that room? It is particularly in your case with respect to the UFO issue that you and Leslie Kane wrote about. What happened in the room where they gave you and Leslie and Helen Cooper, okay, go for it, guys. This is the direction we're going. How did that all work?
Okay, well, we came in with that story. This is how it came down. Leslie Kane had attended a meeting in Washington, D.C. with Lou Elizondo, who was the head of this secret office of the Pentagon investigating UFOs. It was called ATIP. And found out that he was ready to resign, or had just already resigned because he was unhappy with the lack of support he was getting. So there was, we found out there's a secret office in the Pentagon investigating UFOs, and officially the government got out of the UFO business in 1969 with Blue Book, but we found out that it was still going on. So we had everybody on the record. We came back to the Times and said we have the resignation letter from Lou Elizondo. We have people confirming his resignation. We have comments on the record of people who knew about this, office in the Pentagon. We have Navy videos of encounters with some of these objects, which were sensational. We put them up on the Times webpage. Became among the most, watched things the New York Times ever put up to this day. But I think what impressed the editors was the fact that we had all this on the record. There were no, background anonymous sources. We had documents. It was solid. And to their credit, the editors saw this. They resisted the ridicule factor that always, accompanies this.
Of course,
subject,
yeah.
Wherever you go. And they put it on the front page on a Sunday, a very prominent, position in the paper. And it did cause a sensation. The Times was giving credence to this thing that had been talked about only, on supermarket tabloids, let's say. I don't want to belittle the hard work other people had done until that point. We weren't the first.
Of course, yeah.
UFO reporting, but the combination of the New York Times clout that the paper has, the credibility that the paper has, and it was a solidly reported story, I think it really changed the paradigm, as we've since heard.
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, you're right, because when I talk about this to my colleagues within the UFO research community, there are certain bookmarks that happen in history. And you could think back to, any number of things, Blue Book and all the other things that happened with respect to sightings and Roswell and all of that. Those are individual bookmarks in history. I put a bookmark on December 2017 as the point at which the movement towards disclosure, at least some sort of openness or acknowledgement about this issue, came into prevalence. You guys set the tone for what happened over the next 3 to 5 years. And rightly so, it's still occurring. Do you feel that that kind of bookmark situation does really apply to what you did in December of 2017?
We went on since then to some other stories in a kind of a progression talking about the actual sightings, the encounters that pilots had. We got the pilots on the record, and the last story was a difficult dive into possible materials and what the government may know or actually have in its possession, which remains very unclear and mostly classified.
Yeah, it's amazing the way it's evolved since then, because maybe we can get into it a little bit later on, but what's happened since then, especially with respect to the Senate and Marco Rubio and all of that, that really has, Harry Reid, it really has sort of set a tone for the way disclosure or acknowledgement might go. Okay, we're with Ralph Blumenthal, and we're talking about a myriad of things with respect to his book, The Believer, and we'll be back in a moment. And don't you go away. You're listening to The Files of the Disclosure Agency, and my name is Victor Vigiani.
In 1994, Dr. Mack visited South Africa, the Harare School in Zimbabwe. He had been told that a group of children had witnessed the landing of an oval-shaped silver craft that hovered above their playground. He spoke to one of the children.
But the one you said that they were doing harm to the earth, how did that get communicated to you?
I don't know.
But somehow it did, is that?
Yeah, it came through my head.
Through your head? Did it, through words or?
My conscience, I think.
Your what?
My conscience.
It came through your conscience told you?
Yeah.
I mean, while you were in contact with the being, you mean? Or
while the being was looking at me.
While it was looking at you, your conscience told you that.
Mm-hmm. And welcome back to the Files of the Disclosure Agency. My name is Victor Vigiani, and we're with Ralph Blumenthal. During the last session, we talked about the New York Times and some of the aspects of John Mack's personality. I want to go back to John Mack again, Ralph, with something that's really going to, sort of tip off a conversation that we can move upon with respect to what made him do what he wanted to do. He came from a very pragmatic upbringing, materialistic in every sense of the word, in his family. And then a switch flipped in his mind, something kind of switched himself, somehow triggering an understanding of the supernatural or the world of hyper-awareness. And who or what do you think caused that switch or transformation, as Dr. Mack put it, with respect to this thing called the subtle realm, moving from that materialistic world into this really ethereal aspect of the examination of reality?
Right. Well, as you say, he was brought up in a secular German-Jewish household that was very grounded in the material world. His parents were both, his stepmother and father were both professors. They had not much use for spiritual matters or even religious matters. And they impressed on him that the Bible was a book to be read for its poetry, really, but not its spiritual content.
Mm-hmm.
He grows up and he goes to Harvard Medical School, and he becomes a social activist. As I say in the book, his life was a series of enthusiasms and passions. So the first thing he did was he got involved in setting up mental health services for the poor in Cambridge, and then he got involved in his biography of Lawrence of Arabia and Middle East peace that sent him to the Middle East. He met with Yasser Arafat to try to, help move along the peace process. Then he became a big opponent of nuclear weapons and very dangerous for the human race. And lo and behold, he finds himself in Esalen on the West Coast, that think tank for psychic powers, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
He meets a guy named Stan Grof, who's a Czechoslovak psychiatrist, very interested in transpersonal psychiatry, spiritual aspects of psychiatry. And Grof had come up with something called holotropic breathwork, a way of using breathing discipline to induce altered states of consciousness, so drugs without drugs. And Mack was very taken by this idea as a psychiatrist, because he was a great experimenter in altered states of consciousness, including some experiments with LSD. So he subjected himself to this breath work, and he found himself recalling maybe a previous life when he was a Russian peasant, maybe He remembered being born and the struggles that his mother had before she died at 8 and a half, when he was 8 and a half months. So he started to develop this spiritual awareness of things that were not materialistic. And then he gets an invitation to meet with Bud Hopkins, who was an artist who had really pioneered the whole study of alien abduction, because he had once seen a UFO and got interested in the field, taught himself hypnosis, and gathered these abductees around him and investigated them before John Mack ever heard of it and before it was really popular. I mean, Bud Hopkins was really one of the first. And John Mack meets him, and Bud Hopkins shares the letters he's gotten from people with these strange stories. And that's what started getting John interested. And he was ripe for it because he said, Stan Groff opened up my psyche and the UFOs flew in.
Right.
I love that quote that I have in the book, because it really shows how his consciousness was expanded to the point where he was open to this whole new, you know, spiritual realm of UFOs. So that's how he got into it. And then it was his courage that allowed him to continue, even in the face of ridicule by his colleagues.
Mm-hmm. What flipped your switch to get involved in this on a belief level, or even say, yeah, yes, this is something really intense that I need to kind of, you know, get into?
Yeah, it's a good question. You see, I came to this the same way John Mack did. When I look back on it, was just following the same trail he was. He just took all these accounts of people, and he tried to understand what was going on with them. The first thing he decided was that they were not insane, the people who were reporting these stupefying experiences, encounters with aliens. He was a psychiatrist, so he knew, certainly, you know, how to distinguish between people who are mentally ill and not. So he said, okay, they're not crazy, they're not deluded, they're not publicity seeking, because if anything, they're hiding from their experiences. They don't want to talk about it. They're not fabricating it. And besides, it's happening to young children too, because he found kids as young as 2 years old were talking about meeting little men and flying up in the sky in the spaceship. And he said, you can't, you know, think that little kids are influenced by the books they've read or the movies they've seen or the cultural milieu. So somewhere these kids are getting these stories. So he's putting this all together. And as I said, he's following a series of clues. And I did the same thing when I started looking into his story. As an investigative reporter myself, I didn't buy into it as a fantasy writer and say, oh, good, I'm, you know, I want to believe in UFOs. I wanted to see what was it that influenced him and why did he take it so seriously. And I ended up taking it seriously because I looked at his research and the research of a lot of other people, real scholars and scientists who really been, you know, affected by this mystery, which it is. It's a mystery to this day. No one has solved it. Despite what the so-called skeptics say, oh, I have the answer to that. These people are mentally ill. You know. Anyway, nobody knows. So I was struck just as John Mack was. So I basically followed his footsteps. And what was it that attracted him? It's attracting me too. And let's see what stands up and what doesn't. So that's basically what got me into it. And I really take pains throughout the book to, you know, maintain my distance. I hope readers cannot find out till the end of the book what I really think of all this stuff, my own opinion, because I think it really gets in the way. I want to report, you know, what was going on in John Mack's mind and what was happening in the field.
Uh-huh.
And then at the end, I kind of drop a hint. Can I do a spoiler alert and tell you?
Well, let me interject there, because when I was reading the book, Ralph, this is really interesting you should bring this up, because I kept on reading and reading, and I said, when's he going to inject a little bit of himself in this thing? And you stayed away from it till, I don't know, chapter 45 or 40, whatever it was. And then, I won't do a spoiler either, but towards the end, you really get into the headspace of your own quote-unquote belief system. And I got to congratulate you during the book not injecting things, because you did. It would have gotten in the way, wouldn't it, I think, in exposing who John Mack was.
Yeah. You know, You know, by the same token, let me say that people often ask John Mack, have you ever been abducted? They asked him, have you seen a UFO? And he always said, to his regret somewhat, no, I haven't been abducted. No, I never saw a UFO. I can say the same thing.
Right.
And he said that kept me pure, you know, purely from an outside standpoint. If he'd come forward and say, yeah, I was abducted, and people probably wouldn't give him the same credence. So
right.
I can say with no, I've had no involvement myself.
Yeah.
I come to it as an outsider.
That's good. In writing a biography like this, you get to know the person, in this case John Mack, you're writing about in an almost existential way. In getting to know John Mack through all of the research you did, not necessarily meeting with the man because you couldn't, why, against all odds, do you sense that he chose the path he did, or did the path choose him?
I think a little of both. That raises a really interesting question. I think books choose authors as much as authors choose books. There were a lot of synchronicities that came up, you know, these wormholes through the cosmos that connect events and people without us understanding why. So it turns out that John Mack's father was a professor at City College when I was a student at City College. I only found out this later. His stepmother was a New Deal economist, and she wrote papers that turned up at Baruch College, where I worked in the archives. Mack's cousin, who gave me great biographical details, lived across the street from me, it turned out. So anyway, it was a combination of things. He found the subject, and the subject found him. He relished notoriety. He wasn't afraid to be out front. He liked the attention. He loved being on TV. He was good at it. To answer your question, I think it was a bit of both. He chose the subject, and the subject found him.
Yeah, I guess that pretty well sums it up. Pinocchio and the Turquoise Lady. Expound.
Okay, so as I said, John Mack, his whole life was really searching for his dead mother. And one of the stories that affected him deeply, and as a psychiatrist, he was always analyzing himself, just like he analyzed, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, he analyzed himself. And he was always attracted to the Pinocchio story. And he realized, and he wrote this in his private papers, and I picked it up from my book, that Pinocchio is created by his father, carved out of wood. He has conflicts with his father, Freudian conflicts. He is saved by this turquoise maiden, this magical woman who might be a stand-in for his dead mother, and he lies to her. And when he lies, his nose gets very long, which is an obvious sexual reference. He loved the Pinocchio story, and he saw elements of himself in that. He also loved The Wizard of Oz, because it was a story of characters in search of qualities they already possess. He gave a very interesting analysis, things that I never even realized, what lies behind that. The Wizard of Oz, a very mythic story. You know, the lion is looking for courage, and he has courage. The Tin Man is, you know, looking for a heart, and he has a heart.
Right.
And Mack was sort of the same way. He was looking for things, and he possessed those qualities. The courage to pursue it, the intellect, the curiosity. So I didn't want to become an armchair psychiatrist, you know, analyzing him, but these things were just too obvious to ignore.
Yeah, you really can't ignore things like that, because you go into great detail about how he felt about that and how it was a center of some of the ways that he approached just about everything. We're just about to take a break, but on the other side of the break, I do want to get back into the psyche of this man and how he literally, as you put, he virtually agonized about just about everything that came into his realm. So on the other side of the break, we'll get to that. So we're speaking with Ralph Blumenthal. My name is Victor Vigiani, and you're listening to the Files of the Disclosure Agency. You stay right where you are.
My name is Don Emilio Zeno, producer of the Files of the Disclosure Agency, coming to you from our production center in Montreal, Canada. The Files of the Disclosure Agency is a production of the Z-Lan Communications Network and is written, produced, and sent to you from our studios in Toronto, and Montreal, Canada. You can find all episodes of the Files of the Disclosure Agency on our Zealand Communications website, or simply Google Zealand Communications.
Welcome back to the Files of the Disclosure Agency. My name is Victor Vigiani, and it's great to have you with us. We're listening to and talking to and enthralled by Ralph Blumenthal, the author of The Believer, the story of John Mack. Before the break, we talked about several different things. I'd like to bring up a little bit more to get into some more depth with respect to the psyche of John Mack for two reasons. First of all, Ralph, because you did some incredible research about it and much more of it that I could ever even imagine doing. But in my interactions with John Mack in the mid-90s, in visiting him at his Harvard office in Cambridge, the steely eyes were something that really kind of struck me was one thing, and then his deliberateness was another. But throughout the book, you described Mack as speaking of his world and himself as becoming disembodied. And I did not get this feeling at all when I met him. And he seemed to agonize over everything, as you put it. How could someone of that intellectual capacity be so overwhelmed to become so disintegrated by everything that he was getting involved in? It just seemed to be something that just fell into his lap every time he did something. But then again, he was helping other people reintegrate their lives. How do you put those two things together?
Well, as we talked about, it was really very conventional to begin with. It was very well grounded in material, conventional science and medicine. But encountering these stories that he could not get to the bottom of, and nobody ever has, it really changed his outlook. And he began to look at everything with new eyes. And one of the points I make in the book is it wasn't just alien abduction that intrigued him. That was the starting point for his forays into all kinds of other paranormal issues and anomalies. He became interested in crop circles and life after death and, the Holy Grail legend and Bigfoot and, cattle mutilations and all these weird things that are part of the same larger mystery. And this is what he failed to understand in the beginning. He thought he was just tracking alien abduction and that was something separate. And then it turned out it was related to all these other things that were equally mysterious. And at the end of his life, he ended up, fascinated by survival of consciousness, life mm-hmm. after death. So I think it opened up his world, and it was a shock to him. And he was equally shocked by the fact that other people weren't shocked, that he had found this stuff out, but he wasn't getting a good hearing from his colleagues and others in, conventional of academia, who subjected him to some ridicule. So he was very disappointed that he could not really make enough traction to get the subject moved, back into the mainstream.
Yeah, it's almost like someone going into a museum to look at meteorites and landing up, moving through the entire museum and being fascinated by everything in the entire museum. It seems to be the life of John Mack, the way he just sort of, he was a magnet to things that were puzzling to him. Yeah, let's go into for a second the Oprah Winfrey television interview. You went into some real detail about that particular interview. Do you want to describe the nature of the interview and how things flowed in that event?
Well, in 1994, John was about to publish his first book, Abduction, which is really the case histories of 13 people. He gave them pseudonyms, but they were the detailed stories of their encounters with aliens. And by the way, we never even talked about who these aliens, what they looked like. So let's do that for a moment. John was very forthcoming in describing the stories that people came to him with. And, the common story was that they'd be in their bedroom or driving a car, and they'd become aware of a UFO, and the next thing, there'd be these little robotic kind of guys, little creatures, 3 feet tall in some kind of strange jumpsuits with elliptical black eyes and telepathic powers that they could communicate to human beings with. And the next thing, these people were being flown up into a spaceship, and subject to, you know, bizarre medical, pseudo-medical tests. Sometimes women had their eggs removed and men had sperm taken, and hybrid babies were produced that the people saw on subsequent abduction. These are the stories that people were telling him. So you can imagine how that blew his mind, and he couldn't shake, you know, the story. So anyway, these were the stories that he told in his book. And of course, there was a great interest in the book, a psychiatrist telling these stories. So he gets invited on the Oprah show in 1994 with a number of his abductees, his experiencers, as he called them. And they told their stories firsthand. And Oprah was kind of blown away. Mm. And she was asking, you know, why, you know, because she was trying to understand it herself. And the audience, the live audience, was trying to understand it. So this aired. It had a tremendous viewership, and maybe not quite as much as Meghan and Harry, but a lot. And that caused repercussions at Harvard because they thought they were, that John Mack was making them look ridiculous, that he was not acting like a Harvard psychiatrist should act. He was becoming much too popular, and academia could not, you know, he was jealous maybe over his bestsellers. So all these things. Anyway, that show did a lot to, you know, expand his reputation. For better or worse.
Yeah, it seems that almost that John took the better and the worse all together as one flow of information that he could just digest at any given time. Although he was affected by it physically and even emotionally, he tended to really roll with the punches. Let's spend a moment for a second on the media and the way the media really portrays or has portrayed this issue both then and now with respect to how it, you know, delved into it a little bit before, but now the media seems to be really, generally speaking, the media seems to be getting into this stuff. How do you explain the media interest right now, currently? Are they just sort of catching up with it? Are they that far behind the curve still? And where might the media go with respect to what you have written in the New York Times and even your book? Where is this all going to go in the media?
Well, a big factor today is that it's being treated more seriously, and that's in part because of the Pentagon, official Pentagon interest. The Defense Authorization Act that was passed over President Trump's veto in the end of his presidency provided for this UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon Task Force. They like UAP better than UFOs. Mm-hmm. The word. So there's a UAP task force now officially, you know, in the Pentagon, and they're supposed to issue a report within 180 days of the passage of the act, so probably sometime early summer, and we don't know how detailed that's going to be, but the Pentagon has issued, the Navy has issued instructions. They want pilots to report encounters, which they never did before. These videos have been acknowledged now officially that we published in the New York Times, videos of encounters with tic-tacs, so-called, very strange objects that fly at super, super fast speeds that the pilots have no idea what they're chasing. So there is a level of acknowledgement and seriousness now that is dictating the more serious coverage in the mainstream press. And you see it in the stories, for example, of the American Airlines pilot the other day, object fly over him, and that was reported. Pilots used to be told, do not report UFOs because they'll say you're crazy, you'll have to take away your license. So now they're being encouraged to report these things. So to answer your question, I think there is a greater appreciation in the media for the seriousness of the subject, and no one's yet talking about aliens. That's too far out. There's right. No confirmation of that. You know, they're not spotted the way UFOs are spotted. So one thing at a time.
No, I think you're exactly right. They've moved along the continuum so well, so that openness is really providing us with a landscape where the next step might be the admission, you know, from the state. Well, we don't know where these things are from, but the next step just might be the use of the ET word, you know. What I'd like to do, Broach, you brought it up just a second ago regarding that Authorization Act and how the Senate Intelligence Committee is demanding some sort of report from the Director of National Intelligence. Once that report is brought forward, and Mark Warner, he's now the chair, if I'm correct, of the Select Senate Committee on Intelligence. Once that report comes forward and Mark Warner has a sense that, well, here's some information, what are we going to do with it? One of the things that I've talked to a lot of researchers about is the possibility of Senate or congressional hearings. How do you see that possibly playing out, if it does, and what kind of witnesses might they call? How might that all happen as the next stage in the evolution of what you started back in 2017?
You know, I'm not sure that is the next step because, you know, there's a lot of classified material here. There's a great feeling in the government that this technology is potentially world-changing. Every country, every sophisticated country on Earth, principally China, Russia, Israel, Iran, us, are working on trying to figure out what are the propulsion systems of these amazing craft, reverse engineer it. How do you, what's the power plant? How do we, dominate? How do we employ this technology? And the last thing that anyone in the government wants to do is, be transparent about how much we know and share it with our adversaries. So sanguine that there's going to be hearings. I think a lot of the stuff that we try to find out for the New York Times is classified. When we try to delve into the question of materials, does the government have, do contractors have actual materials from crashed craft? We can't find out. We reported some of it, that there was Congress was briefed on some of this stuff, but the briefings are top secret. So you're in a world where the information is really hard to come by, and it's tough to report on it for the Times because we can't get access to classified material. We don't want to go to jail.
Of course.
And people don't want to talk to us about it.
Right.
So I'm not sure that we're going to end up with hearings, or if we do, there's going to be a classified version and a public version, an open version, which may not be that interesting.
Yeah.
Or maybe interesting. Or maybe interesting. Who knows?
That's right. Yeah. just before the break, we want to go into one more segment. A pointed question. Have you ever been told or found out something that you were told not to report on?
Well, we're often told by our sources, don't report this. Or I can't go on the record with this, and that means we can't really use it. What your question suggests, Victor, which is interesting, is have we or I ever been approached by the government not to talk about certain things? And the answer is no. John Mack himself said he was never censored. He never had a visit from the Men in Black telling him, scaring him or intimidating him. He was never threatened in any way, which is interesting because, there's a lot of conspiracists out there, and they're saying that, these people know stuff, but the government won't let them say it. John Mack said, and I believe him, he had no reason to lie about it, he was never confronted, never threatened, never got a visit from anybody in the government, don't say this, so, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And nor have we at the Times, as far as I know.
Yeah.
But that doesn't say that these Men in Black incidents haven't occurred. I talk about some of them.
You do in the book, yes.
They are very strange stories.
Oh.
If we had more time, I could tell some of them. But it is very weird. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
No, that's a good answer to the question. Once again, we're just about ready to take another break, and maybe on the other side we can get back to John, and I've got one or two more questions that we can broach. So you're listening to The Files of the Disclosure Agency, and my name is Victor Vigiani, and we will be back in a few moments. You just stay right where you are.
The date is June 29th, 2008, 6:32 p.m. I'm creating this message to let the people of the world, whoever happens to hear this, know the truth about what is going on with regards to the alien presence in our world as well as interstellar space and within our own solar system.
Welcome back to the Files of the Disclosure Agency. My name is Victor Vigiani, And we just have here in the last segment Mr. Ralph Blumenthal, and we are going to extend this conversation just a little bit. Ralph, I wanted to talk to you a little bit in dealing with all of this abduction stuff. I know Dr. Mack struggled with his own sexuality while dealing with the extreme sexual nature of the abduction phenomenon. How are those two things linked, or were they in fact linked at all?
Well, when you say he struggled with sexuality, let's not leave the impression that he had any kind of gender confusion. He was definitely a macho male,
yeah,
interested in women, and he did chase. I don't want to say chased women. He came across women in the course of his work who attracted him, and he found himself. It was difficult for him to, you know, stay faithful to his wife. Let's put it that way. He was not promiscuous. He just fell in love with some women along the way and talked about in his journals, which I had access to. But what he encountered in his research were these stories about men and women being abducted and put aboard these craft and subjected to reproductive procedures where the eggs were harvested from women, their pregnancies were removed, and sperm was collected from men, the stories were that a hybrid race was being produced and the people were reabducted later to visit their hybrid children. Now, it's important to say, because science is a part of my story, that there has never been, to my knowledge, a case of a confirmed lost pregnancy as a result of an abduction aboard a ship. The women felt that they had been pregnant. They felt they were pregnant. Then they felt they lost the baby. They felt they were taken aboard a craft and shown their hybrid child, okay? And no doctor has been found who said, yes, I verified that this woman was pregnant on this day, and on this day she suddenly wasn't pregnant. And, I mean, there are many cases, obviously, of miscarriages and things like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's one of the elusive aspects of this whole abduction thing. There are no pictures, verified pictures of the aliens. The evidence is, the physical evidence is fragmentary, which Mack acknowledged. People have had scars coming back from abduction experiences, which are hard to explain. There's areas where UFOs seem to have landed, and the grass is, you know, shows different patterns, landing patterns, etc. But these are all very fragmentary, you know, bits of evidence. Physical proof is very, very difficult in these cases, and that could be because the aliens are so smart that they cover their tracks, or it could be that this is happening in some kind of dimension that doesn't lend itself to physical remains or evidence. Anyway, you asked about sexuality, so there it is. And it's very uncomfortable for some of these experiences to talk about, to admit that they, you know, were forced into providing sperm or their eggs for women. It's a very difficult subject. People break down when they recount these, and there's an episode in my book where a woman's recording being interviewed by John Mack. He plays that for a Harvard audience where a woman is weeping. It's hair-raising. The tape, and of course the tape is just referred to in the book. You know, you can't hear it. But if you do hear it, it is shattering to hear her genuine anguish. And this is what convinced John Mack, listening to these stories. These people were not making it up. He, as a psychiatrist, was convinced. You don't make up stories like this with that level of emotion. So again, that was a powerful factor to him, that these people were recounting these awful, awful experiences. And that's really what convinced him, large part, that it was real on some level.
Yeah, along with, you know, Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs and a number of other people who've talked about the same kind of thing, but in a different way. After you describe how John met his fate in London when he was killed, several months later, I'm not sure exactly how long it was, Barbara Lamb describes some sort of manifestation from John. Could you talk about that for a moment? Because that really, really interested me when I read it.
I end the book essentially with a memorial service in Boston. And then I say, okay, after he died, there were some accounts by his friends of seeing him or his spirit return. Now I say, look, this is a different character than the rest of the book. The rest of the book is pretty much founded in, you know, verifiable experiences that were recounted by named people and more founded in actual reporting. Now there's people coming forward saying, I saw John Mack after he died, or his spirit came to me, etc. And I say, I'm not investing this with the same credibility as the rest of the book, but I'm reporting it because people told me that. So Barbara Lamb, who has been a friend of John's and told a very powerful story about an encounter she had with him both before he died and after he died, did tell a story that she was visiting her daughter in California, and Barbara had an allergic reaction to her daughter's cat, went outside to sleep on the porch because it was in the open air, and suddenly couldn't breathe and was choking to death. And she saw an image of John, and a ball of light came down onto her chest and suddenly eased her choking, and she felt John say, you're going to be all right, Barbara, just breathe. So that was one story, which she told me. And there were other stories like that. And again, John, at the end of his life, was interested in survival consciousness, afterlife experiences. These fit into that. It's kind of interesting that he was interested in that field at the end of his life, and here he is, according to these people, coming back. So, again, another mystery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If he was still with us and you had a chance to sit down with him, what would be one of the key questions that you might pose to him, knowing what you know now?
Well, I guess I would ask him about his trajectory, because he went from, as I said, a materialist, not believing any of this stuff, to being very involved with, and captivated by alien abduction, and then expanding his view to take in a lot of other paranormal experiences. And he also backed away from the idea that this had to be happening in conventional reality. In the mm-hmm. beginning, he agreed more with Hopkins and Jacobs that this was real. This was really happening in everyday reality. And Hopkins and Jacobs continued basically to believe that and to suggest that as their take on this whole thing. Aliens were evil. They had come to Earth for some nefarious purpose. And all these traumatic experiences ensued. John increasingly believed that there was something else going on. The aliens or whatever these beings were sent to transform humanity, to start thinking more spiritually, to care more about the Earth. It wasn't necessarily happening in our dimension or reality, maybe another dimension. We don't know how it connected, but it can't be proven. He agreed with Harvard, it can't be proven by conventional scientific methods. So I would ask him about this transformation he made, and some of his friends actually held it against him. You're backing away from, and you're throwing us to the wolves. You're saying that it's not true anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, because In opposition to what Bud Hopkins and what David Jacobs and others have done, they more or less reported the nuts and bolts of the situation, but John went into much more detail with respect to, as you said, the transformative nature of what he was involved in, and how, especially when the young girls that he interviewed at the aerial school, when they came out and said, we're ruining the planet, he really was fixated on that kind of thing. Towards the end of the book, you write, you spent 15 years researching all the stuff and intricacies of his life. And I'm going to say something, I'm going to paraphrase you. You said something like, sometimes, I'm speaking about you now, okay? Sometimes I awoke from a restless night with a nagging insight into Mac that I absolutely had to include in the book. I came to see a pattern of Mac's odyssey, a passion for nuclear disarmament and world peace and the ultimate survival of consciousness after death. In the end, he said, there was something of every man in John Mack. Your thoughts on that?
I do come to believe in these downloads from the universe. Other people have remarked on this. Scientists get sudden ideas, breakthroughs in their thinking, and they can't explain how they suddenly came up with that thought. I kept thinking about things that I have to include in the book, and I kind of believe that these thoughts were being given to me. I don't know. I just felt I had insights suddenly that I didn't have before. So I think there's something to that. I do. I'm not saying John Mack, you know, was sending me signals from the beyond. It's not that, you know, cut and dried, but I do feel that there's some consciousness in the universe that we don't understand. Certainly physics is coming up with new findings all the time that challenge our conventional understanding of how distant objects can affect each other. I mean, extraordinary, you know, and how space and time, you know, warped wormholes and, you know, all these things. We're not at the end of our understanding of the physical universe. We're at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And as I said in the book, never mind where aliens came from, where did this table and chair come from?
Yeah, you said that.
Why does anything exist? We don't know that. We don't know what the dark matter is that makes up the universe. We don't know dark energy. We don't know anything. How can we dismiss, you know, some of these concepts? We just don't know. And that's what I'd like to leave readers with, that, you know, keep an open mind, as John Mack was encouraged to do, and see what comes out. Don't just dismiss everything as nonsense.
Yeah. Well, I do want to reinforce the idea that the book that you wrote is just incredibly densely packed with information about this man. In reading it, I felt myself, I've got to stop here just because my mind is getting overtaken by this man, both you and John Mack. But I found myself compelled to read on and on and on. And I know the readers who do purchase your book will feel exactly the same way. Tell us a little bit about where our listeners can go to find out a bit more about you and your book and how to order it. And I understand the release date is March 15th, or it's available right now. Could you just talk to us a bit about that?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's people have been getting it on Amazon, and other booksellers have it already. I'm all over the internet because of my career at the New York Times. So if you Google or put in a search engine Ralph Blumenthal, my website is ralphblumenthal.com. I have information on the book, ways to order it, biography of myself, some of my articles in the Times recently. So, today it's a lot easier to find out about people than it used to be when I started in journalism, where you had to go to the library, you know, look stuff up in the archives.
That's right.
So, I encourage anyone who's interested in the subject, the John E. Mack Institute has a lot of his work posted. And today, as I say, all you have to do is Google John Mack, Google me, Google the subject of aliens, and you will be confronted with a wealth of information.
Mm-hmm. Well, earlier I described December of 2017 as a bookmark in history with respect to the revelations of the Pentagon and the U.S. Navy. That definitely was a bookmark in history. And Ralph, what I think you've done, and I think our listeners need to know, that you've set forth and you put in place another bookmark with your book, because it will indeed be something that will, first of all, captivate people, and it will enlighten them far beyond what anything that history could tell us about John Mack. I have my own perceptions of the man, my own memories. And in reading it, I can almost visualize him sitting beside me, looking at the text, saying, "Oh my goodness, Ralph knows that about me. That is fascinating." And it just seems to be something that's just endemic to your book. And I want to congratulate you for a great piece of work. And I hope that we can ask you back at some time when things kind of unfold in another way to have you back.
Absolutely, I'd be delighted. Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, thanks very much, Ralph. Thank you very much, everyone, for staying with us and listening to one of the most profound podcast segments that I've ever done. And I want to invite you to respond to this in any way you can, and go to the files of the Disclosure Agency at Zealand Communications. We will talk to you soon, and thank you for listening. Bye for now.
The files of the disclosure agency was recorded at the Z-Lan Communication Studios in Toronto, Ontario. Series producer, Don Emilio Zeno. Sound engineer, Brian Thomas. Research, Victor Vigiani. Follow us on Twitter at Z-Lan. That's Z-L-A-N-D. Let's talk again soon.